pajama tops so that the back of his penis was proudly displayed. And to top it off, he farted a lot, thus becoming a subject of great hilarity for my brother and me. We used to bring our friends over for a tour of the house, and if Harry was home, there were always great gales of laughter. Anyway, the whole manicurist thing made marriage to my mother awkward, coupled with the taking of all her money. So she took a musical in New York to get out of the marriage, which, in Hollywood, is a legal way to dissolve a union without involving lawyers. So when I was about 16, my mother took me out of high school and moved my brother and myself to New York for the year, and she put me in the chorus of her show. I don't care what you've heard. Chorus work is far more valuable to a child than any education could ever be. I grew up knowing that I had the prettiest mother of anyone in my class. As long as I was in class, even after, though, she was the funniest, the prettiest, the kindest, most talented. I had the only tap dancing mother. In New York, we all lived on a nice little street on the Upper West Side, sandwiched conveniently between a music school and a funeral home. Anyway, on one particular evening, I was out on the town with some of the other kids from the chorus of the show, trying my best to be very grown up, as they were all at least 10 years older than I was. Well, somehow my mother knew what restaurant or club we were all at, so at about 10 or 10:30, someone comes and tells me my mother's on the phone. Well, I'm not thrilled to have my hijinks interrupted by my mommy, reminding everyone that I'm far younger than they are and not to be taken seriously. Shit. So I grumble through the people and tables, making my way to the waiting phone. Yeah, Mom, hey, could I talk to you she interrupts me. I'm at the hospital with your brother. He shot himself in the leg with a blank. What? I say. He'll be fine, dear, she continues. He's in surgery now, and they're cleaning the gunpowder out of the wound. He's very lucky. A few inches up, and he could have blown his penis off. Dear, please, language. Anyway, the police are here, and they want to come to the house to examine the gun. Apparently, if it can shoot blanks, though I don't know, they're saying it might be an unregistered firearm or unlicensed something. I don't know. Anyway, where was I? The police, I remind her. Oh, yes. Now, dear, I need you and Pinky. My mother's hairdresser's name was naturally Pinky. I need you to get to the house before the police to let them in. But I also need you to go through the house and hide all the guns and bullets and what else? Oh, yes. I need you to flush your brother's marijuana down the toilet. So you think you can do this, dear? Let me talk to Pinky. Well, this part was kind of thrilling, I have to say. Who knew we had bullets and guns in the house? Granted, they were my stepfather's show guns that he wore ridiculously in some Christmas parade some years back. But it turned out it was considered a firearm. We were suddenly more like a mafia family than a show business one. So Pinky and I rush back to our townhouse and hide the guns and bullets in the washing machine. They'll never look there. And we sadly flush an enormous plastic bag with almost an entire lid of particularly pungent pot. Then I go out to check the scene of the crime, my mother's bedroom, where the shooting had occurred. And I have to say, it was quite something to behold. There are flecks of blood all over the walls and a considerable amount of blood on the bed. A sheet had been shredded in an effort to make a tourniquet. Wow, this was truly drama, and it was happening in real life, of all places. My real life. Surreal, as it all too frequently became when I was living with my show business family and not the regulars of Scottsdale. But if I thought it was surreal at this point, it was about to get a whole lot surrealer. I know, that's not an actual word. So, now it's Saturday night in New York. You would normally think that this wouldn't be a particularly slow night for crime in New York. But you wouldn't know it by our living room, because we've got 5 homicide policemen milling around, asking my mother pertinent questions about the crime, like, did you know John Wayne? What kind of guy was he? Finally, they tell us, after examining the weapon in question that my brother used in commission of the crime of shooting himself in the leg with a blank, the 5 policemen establish that said gun could actually discharge live ammo, and as such, actual bullets. What all this means is that my mother is in possession of an unlicensed firearm and needs to come down to the local precinct where she would be officially booked for possession of a firearm. So now it's about 4 a.m., and my mother and I are taken down to the police station for her mugshot and to be fingerprinted along with the rest of the hookers and dope fiends and murderers and thieves. So by the time we get home, it's close to 6. And my mother and I are at the kitchen table, totally exhausted. Suddenly, there's a knock at the door. And we look at each other. Well, who could that possibly be at this hour? My mother gets up to see while I wait nervously. When she returns, she's laughing. What? I ask. Who was it? It was a couple of reporters, she explains, catching her breath. They heard Todd had been shot in the leg, and they wanted to know if I had done it for publicity for the show. You know, to drum up additional ticket sales. I so badly wanted to tell them yes, and now I can only do one more Broadway musical, because I only have one child left to shoot for publicity. It's almost dawn, and we're both so tired by now that we're a little punchy, so we begin to invent other reasons why my mother might have shot my brother. We come up with everything from he wouldn't clean his bedroom, to he stopped feeding his turtle, to his grades were down. All perfectly credible as far as we were concerned. The next day, there's a photograph of my brother in the hospital with my mother in a mink hat smiling beside him on the front page of the Daily News. The headline read, Picasso Dies. Now, one detail I neglected to mention is that right after the gun discharged the blank into my brother's upper thigh, my mother was naturally frantic seeing all the blood on her only son. So she did what any mother, frantic with worry for her child's welfare, might do. She called a cab. Anyway, cut to 30 years later. My brother arrives at Kennedy Airport in New York on business, and he gets in a taxi to take him into the city. And as they drive along, the cab driver keeps looking into the rearview mirror at my brother. Finally, my brother asks, is something wrong? And the cab driver says, are you Todd Fisher? And after my brother verifies that he is, the cabbie pulls an old, crumpled, bloody strip of sheet out from the visor over the front passenger side of the car and brandishes it for my brother to see. I drove the cab that took you to the hospital that night with your mom back in the 70s. Of course he did. So the cabbie now has my brother sign the rag, brown and stiff with age, and then he drives back out of my brother's life, presumably forever. A nearby arranged all around her. My mother has moved into a house she bought next door from mine. There's this funny thing that she does now, which is to offer my brother and me things we can have after she's dead. If my eyes happen to rest on anything in her home, she rushes over and says, "Do you like this, dear? Because I can put a little sticker with your name on it to mark it now. Otherwise, I'll leave it for your brother. Of all her things, I guess I would want the blue dress with the blue beads and the blue fur. But the thing is, I'm pretty sure it disappeared. But I still want it sort of passionately. I'll have to ask her to see if she can find it, and if she does, get her to put a red dot on it. As a kid, I remember thinking there is no other mother that even comes close to my mom. Then I became a teenager and thought she was an asshole because, let's face it, it's a teenager's job to find her parent annoying and ridiculous. Just ask my daughter. Anyway, after I was finished thinking she was this trippy lunatic, I realized she was pretty fucking amazing. I mean, she's loyal, she's reliable, she's totally great, seriously. She's also really quick, and she can be really, really witty. She also still performs at the age of 76, and she never misses a show. Whether she's tired or her foot hurts, when she's out there on stage, she's radiant. This woman is the consummate performer. I've watched her for my whole life, and she's got this insanely strong life force. It pours through her veins and her muscles and her heart. She's remarkable. But here's the thing. She's also a little bit eccentric. She's always had a lot of unique ideas. For example, she thought it would be a good idea for me to have a child with her last husband, Richard, because it would have nice eyes. I should probably explain that, you know, my mother had gone through the change so she could no longer have children, and Richard didn't have any children of his own yet. And he had nice eyes. My womb was free, and we're related. Now, my mother didn't bring this up just once or twice like a normal mother would. She brought it up many, many times, and mostly while I was driving. And when I finally suggested to her that this might be an odd idea, she said, "Oh, darling, have you read The Inquirer lately? We live in a very strange world." Well, when The Inquirer becomes your standard for living, you're in a lot of trouble. When I told my grandmother about my mother's idea, she said, "Well, that's not right." The voice of reason. My grandmother Maxine is from El Paso, Texas. My mother's entire clan is from Texas, and my father's people are from South Philly and all around there. So basically, we're white trash. But because of the celebrity factor, I think of us as blue-blooded white trash. I bring my grandmother up because when my mother was about 7, my grandmother locked her in the closet. You know, for not finishing her dinner or homework. My grandmother was the one who told this story, by the way. Anyway, after my mother had been in the closet for about an hour, she asked my grandmother for a glass of water. And my grandmother naturally said, "Why?" And my mother said, "Because I've just spit on all your dresses, and now I've run out of spit, and I want to spit all over your shoes." These are the people I hail from. When I asked my grandmother later why she thought this form of discipline was appropriate, she said, "Well, we did not have Cosmopolitan magazine in those days, so we did not know that it was wrong." Don't you think my family has a really weird relationship with magazines? Anyway, my mother and I never did go forward with the plan for me to have Richard's baby, and I think that that probably turned out to be a good thing. I mean, aside from the obvious, my sister, my daughter, my sister, my daughter, my mother ended up hating Richard, and she had a really good reason. He broke her pension plan and took all the money she'd made since Harry took the first batch. So she says to me at this point, "You know, dear, Eddie's starting to look like the good husband." Eddie, the good husband, by Anton Chekhov. What can you say about my father? My father is unbelievably likable. I mean, you would love him. Now, he also smokes 4 joints a day. Not for medical reasons, so I call him Puff Daddy. But anyway, he is just adorable. There is a reason he was able to get all that high-quality pussy, except for Miss Louisiana, and anyone can make one mistake. So after he wrote his, well, he called it an autobiography. I thought of it more as a novel. After he wrote his novel, Been There, Done That, or, as I like to call it, Been There, Done Them, because it was really just about all the women he'd ever slept with and how the sex was and what their bodies were like. So it is a feel-good read. But after I read it, well, for starters, I wanted to get my DNA fumigated. But I read it partly out of loyalty and partly because the Inquirer had called me to ask how I felt about my father alluding to the fact that my mother was a lesbian in the book. Well, of course, it delighted me! And not that it matters, but my mother is not a lesbian, okay? She's just a really, really bad heterosexual. Both hands, one heart, two moods, and a head. A few years ago, my daughter and I visited my father in San Francisco, where he lives, because there's a really big Chinatown there. Anyway, the day before, he had just gotten these tiny little hearing aids. You know the ones that they fit right inside your ears? They're really, really expensive. Some people say $3,000, others say $5,000. Anyway, really expensive. So he'd gotten them the day before. So the night before, he didn't want to lose them or forget where they were, so he put them in his pillbox next to his bed so he'd remember where they were in the morning. Yep, that's right. He ate them. So whenever he couldn't hear my daughter or myself, we'd yell into his stomach or his ass. Now, he subsequently got those hearing aids again, and I had the opportunity to see them. They're the size of a lima bean, a rubber lima bean with an antenna. Now, look, I adore pills. I'm a huge fan, but these were like none I'd ever seen. Now, I don't know how you are in the morning. I'm not that sharp, but I think I would know if I were eating a rubber lima bean with an antenna. Twice! Well, if you have a life like mine, then these experiences gradually accumulate until you become known as a survivor. This is a term that I truly loathe. But the thing is, when you are a survivor, which, fine, I reluctantly agree that I am, and who over 40 isn't, when you are a survivor, in order to be a really good one, you have to keep getting in trouble to show off your gift. My mother says, well, dear, what are the choices? Not surviving? But then, this is from the woman who, when asked for dating advice, says, for what age? My mother, who incidentally lives next door to me, she calls me to this day and says, hello, dear, this is your mother, Debbie. You know, as opposed to my mother, Vladimir or Jean-Jacques. I have a very loud voice. I used to say my voice was designed to wrest people from dreams. My mother grew up in Texas on the border of Mexico, but she learned to speak properly with the assistance of Lillian Sidney, her vocal coach at MGM. Over time, she was able to gradually but completely lose her accent, unless she got really angry or frustrated with Todd and me. And then she's been known to say, Carrie Francis, y'all get your butts in here. but my mom has what I can only describe as a movie star accent. It's very breathless and elegant, kind of mid-Atlantic. My brother and I frequently talk this way to each other now. Hello, dear, this is your brother, Todd. A few years back, I interviewed my mother for this tragic cable talk show I was doing, and this was for the Mother's Day show. Anyway, we're chatting along pretty gaily for straight people, and then suddenly, somewhere in the middle of our little chat, my mother casually says, "You know, dear, it's like that time when I was a little girl and I was kidnapped." What? Oh, darling, I told you about all of this, but you've just forgotten. Now, this was before my ECT, so there is no way I'd forget something like that. I doubt that even electroconvulsive therapy could banish a story as creepy as that one. So on she goes with this horrendous story, which I'm sure you're all dying to hear, like I was. Just desperate to hear each and every horrifically vivid detail of a story increasingly tinged with darker hues of molestation. Happy Mother's Day, everyone! After my panic subsides somewhat, I hear her saying that when she was 8, or maybe younger, her 18-year-old neighbor and his friend scooped her up for a little joyride. I'll spare you the more grisly details, but the good news is, despite the fact that something extremely unsavory occurred, my mother wasn't, in fact, raped. Anyway, long, gross story short, the father of the boy who encouraged my mom to consider a part of his anatomy a lollipop called my grandmother and pleaded with her not to go to the police. "I guarantee you I'll make sure he never does this again." "How?" asked my grandmother. To which the boy's father somehow conveyed his intention to castrate his son. "I'll fix him so he can't." At this point, my grandmother generously reminded the boy's father that he hadn't actually raped her daughter, to which the father allegedly replied, "I just want to make sure he don't have the chance to do what he done again, and maybe next time it'd be worse. He's disgraced our family enough." Ah, the lovely family stories one has. When I was about 15, my mother had started dating a man named Bob Fallon, and my brother and I called him Bob Fallus because he came equipped with exotic creams and sex toys. You know, aphrodisiacs. Well, actually, anglodisiacs, because we're white. Anyway, thanks to Bob, that Christmas, my mother bought my grandmother and myself both vibrators. Now, as unusual as a gift like this sounds, you have to admit that they are the ideal stocking stuffers. I mean, you can fit the vibrator into the long top part of the stocking and still be able to get another cute little gift in the toe. Well, I have to admit, I enjoyed mine, but my grandmother refused to use hers. She was concerned that it would short-circuit her pacemaker. She said she'd gone this long without an orgasm, she might as well go the whole way. And that pacemaker, by the way, was later recalled. Now look, I know a lot of you might be thinking that many of the stories I'm telling you are way over the top, and I would totally have to agree. But you can't imagine what I'm leaving out. Anyway, I'd been singing in my mother's nightclub act since I was about 13, like most teenagers, and I continued to perform with her until I was 17. The last place that we played together was the London Palladium. And you know, I got pretty good reviews, so this choreographer contacts me and asked me if I want to do my own nightclub act. And I thought, well, maybe. You know, I could end up being financially independent. And Liza Minnelli, but, you know, you take the good with the bad. Anyway, my mother thought that this was a lousy idea. She thought it would be better if I went to drama college in England because it would bring respectability to the family. You know, like we were a bunch of hookers. And drama college in England's the only way to eradicate a taint like that. So now it's 1973, and I'm 17, and I'm enrolled at the Central School of Speech and Drama in London. And like I said, initially it wasn't my idea to go, but once I got there, it was some of the best times of my life. I mean, truly, it was the only unexamined part of my life, where I was just a student among students, going to voice and movement class, and learning weird little tongue twisters, like, all I want is a proper cup of coffee, made in a proper cup of coffee pot. You can believe it or not, but I want a cup of coffee in a proper coffee pot. Tin coffee pots and iron coffee pots, they're no use to me. If I can't have a proper cup of coffee in a proper cup of coffee pot, I'll have a cup of tea. Now, if you enjoyed my performance as Princess Leia, and who could resist my stunning, layered, moving, not unlike Mary Poppins' performance, then it's thanks to tongue twisters like that. Consider, you'll never get that bucket of bolts past that blockade, proper cup of coffee pot. Or, why you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder, proper cup of coffee pot, I'll have a cup of tea. Don't forget, I had that weird little English accent that came and went like weather or bloat all through the movie. And all my friends made fun of me because they said the title of the film sounded like a fight between my original parents. Star Wars! Accumulations of Incarnations. 43 years ago, George Lucas ruined my life. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. And now, 72 years later, people are still asking me if I knew Star Wars was going to be that big of a hit. Yes, of course I knew. We all knew. The only one who didn't know was George Lucas. We kept it from him, because we wanted to see what his face looked like when it changed expression. And he fooled us even then. He got Industrial Light and Magic to change his facial expressions for him, and THX sound to make the noise of a face-changing expression. Not only was he virtually expressionless in those days, but he also hardly talked at all. His only two directions to the three of us in the first film were faster and more intense. Remember the trash compactor scene in the first Star Wars? When Harrison and Mark and Chewie have just rescued me from the prison cell on the Death Star, and we've just slid down the garbage chute and landed on a bunch of Death Star garbage and water? Well, under the water lived this serpent-like creature that in the script was called a Dianoga, though I don't think anyone ever referred to this thing by name in the actual film. So this creature, Dianoga, was meant to slither over to Mark, wrap itself around his neck, and strangle him as it pulled him under the surface of the water, leaving the rest of us up above to flip out. Anyway, during one of the takes, Mark was so intent on making his strangulation look realistic that he ended up bursting a blood vessel in his eye, which in turn left this bright red dot. So the following day, we shot our next scene, which happened to be the last scene in the movie. You know, the one where I give out all the medals? Mark had to grin like a motherfucker in that scene in order to conceal his red dot. Because ultimately, who's going to give a medal to someone with a big, stupid red dot in their eye? I don't care how much force is with him. George also made me take shooting lessons because in the first film, I would grimace horribly at the deafening sound of the blanks from the blasters and the squibs that the special effects team would place all over the set and on the stormtroopers. So George wanted to make me look like I'd been shooting blasters for my entire Alderaan existence. So he sent me to the same man who taught Robert De Niro to shoot weapons in Taxi Driver. Anyway, the shooting range was in this cellar in Midtown Manhattan, populated with policemen and all manner of firearm aficionados. I used to have this fantasy that in some distant Star Wars sequel, we'd finally stop all the shooting and screaming at each other, and we'd go to a shopping and beauty planet, where the stormtroopers would have to get facials, and Chewbacca would have to get pedicures and bikini and eyebrow waxes. I felt that at some point, I should get, okay, fine, maybe not equal time, but just a few scenes where we did a lot of girly things. Imagine the shopping we might have done on Tatooine, or a little Death Star souvenir shop where you could get t-shirts that said, "My parents got the Force and jumped to light speed, and all I got was this lousy t-shirt." Or, "My boyfriend blew Jabba the Hutt, and all I got," etc., etc. You get the gist of my drift. But I have to admit, after a series of weapon instructions from a very pleasant ex-cop, I became quite proficient with an assortment of guns, including a double-barreled shotgun. Obviously, my family was so proud, because for fuck, for Darth's sake, I was always doing their stupid, endless fucking boy things. But back to the first film. Shortly after I arrived, George gave me this unbelievably idiotic hairstyle, and I'm brought before him like some sacrificial asshole, and he says to me in his little voice, "Well, what do you think of it?" And I say, because I'm terrified I'm going to be fired for being too fat, I say, "I love it!" Yeah, and the check's in the mail, and one size fits all, and I'll only put it in a little bit. Because, see, there was this horrible fat thing going on. When I got this great job to end all jobs, which truly I never thought I would get, because there were all these unbelievably pretty girls who were up for the same part. There was Amy Irving and Jodie Foster. This girl Terry Nunn almost got the part. Oh, and Christopher Walken almost got cast as Han Solo. Wouldn't that have been fantastic? Anyway, when I got this job, they told me I had to lose 10 pounds. Well, I weighed about 105 at the time, but, to be fair, I carried about 50 of those pounds in my face. So you know what a good idea would be? Give me a hairstyle that further widens my already wide face! So you see, George Lucas is a sadist. But, like any abused child wearing a metal bikini chained to a giant slug about to die, I keep coming back for more. Now why, you might ask? Well, I would answer, let's face it, George Lucas, the guy's a visionary, right? He's transported audiences the world over, and he's provided Mark and Harrison and myself with enough fan mail and even a small merry band of stalkers, keeping us entertained for the rest of our unnatural lives, not to mention identities that will follow us to our respective graves like a vague exotic smell. And speaking of graves, I tell my younger friends that one day they'll be at a bar playing pool, and they'll look up at the television set and there'll be a picture of Princess Leia with two dates underneath her face. And they'll say, "Oh, she said that would happen." And then they'll go back to playing pool. And don't forget, George Lucas was the man who made me into a little doll. And it barely even hurt. A little doll that one of my exes could stick pins into whenever he was annoyed with me. I found it in a drawer. He also made me into a shampoo bottle where people could twist off my head and pour liquid out of my neck. Paging Dr. Freud! And then there was a soap. A soap which read, "Lather up with Leia and you'll feel like a princess yourself." Boys. Oh, and the nice people at Burger King? They made me into a watch. And you know Mr. Potato Head? Well, they just came out with a Mr. Potato Head Star Wars series, so you might recognize me as Princess Tater, with my husband Dick and our daughter Rehabilitator. And I'm a tiny little stumpy Lego thing, which are delicious, by the way. And now there's even a stamp, which is totally cool, and not only because of the licking. But the main thing I've been made into that is really enhance the quality of my life enormously? I'm a Pez dispenser. True story. Which not only has made my life unbelievably great, but it's enhanced the lives of everyone I run into. So if you can get someone to make you into a Pez dispenser, do it! And my daughter loves it because, you know, like I told you, she's a teenager, and they love to humiliate the parent for sport. So all she has to do is flip my head back and pull a wafer out of my neck. But, you know, ultimately, I really don't mind. Even though, among George's many possessions, he owns my likeness, so that every time I look in the mirror, I have to send him a couple of bucks. That's partly why he's so rich. You know, because I'm vain, so I look in the mirror a lot, and it adds up. You know, I saw yet another Leia figurine recently at one of those comic book conventions, which, yes, I go to when I'm lonely. Anyway, this particular doll was on a turnstile, and when it got to a particular place on the turnstile, you could actually see up my dress to my anatomically correct, though shaved, galaxy snatch. Well, as you can imagine, because this probably happens to you all the time, I was a little taken aback by this. So I called George, and I said, "You know what, man? Owning my likeness does not include owning my Lagoon of Mystery." Oh, and remember the white dress I wore all through the first movie? I mean, unless you didn't see Star Wars. Anyway, George comes up to me the first day of filming, and he takes one look at the dress, and he says, "You can't wear a bra underneath that dress." So I say, "Okay, I'll bite. Why?" And he says, "Because there's no underwear in space." I promise you this is true. And he says it with such conviction, too, you know, like he'd been to space and looked around and didn't see any bras or panties or briefs anywhere. Now, George came to my show when we did it in Berkeley, and he came backstage and he explained why you can't wear your brassiere in other galaxies. And I have a sense that you'll be going to outer space very soon, so here's why you cannot wear your brassiere, per George. So what happens is, you go to space and you become weightless. So far so good, right? But then your body expands, but your bra doesn't. So you get strangled by your bra. Now, I think this would make a fantastic obit. So I tell my younger friends that no matter how I go, it will be reported that I drown in moonlight, strangled by my bra. But, you know, George actually does have a point. Because, you know, when they send out those space probes and they beam back footage of what it looks like up there? All those films ever really show are sand and rocks. I mean, I've never seen a bra in any of that footage. So, instead of a bra, what do you think I wore for a bra intergalactically? Gaffer's tape! I used to think there should have been a contest at the end of the day for who in the crew would get to help remove the tape. Well, I was just thinking of others. Even then, I was just giving. But clearly, they've gone as far as they can go with this whole doll thing. I mean, what are they going to do next? Make a life-size Leia doll? You know, a kind of Stepford Leia? Which would render me obsolete. You'd read her book. So thank God they haven't done that. And thank God they haven't come up with a life-size Leia sex doll, because that would be truly humiliating. Thank God they haven't made an $800 sex doll that you can put in your cornfield to chase away crows. Oh, wait a second. They have! Okay, I admit, I knew about this. And I have to say it does turn out to be kind of a useful thing. Because if ever anyone tells me to go fuck myself, I can actually get the doll and give it a whirl. Well, this actually happened one night at my show. Someone from the far balcony screamed, "Go fuck yourself, Carrie!" So I had the crew load up the doll into my car. I took it back to my hotel, and I gotta tell you, I spent hours. Now, I need to point something out to you. This doll is cement. Now, I don't know how erotic that is for you, but it just doesn't do it for me anymore. Anyway, about 3:30 a.m., I tried to get the doll to do something with her hand and just fell off. So about 4 a.m., I think, oh my God, epiphany. The doll is heterosexual. But I really have no way of proving this theory because I no longer have a penis. It's been revoked until the financial crisis is over. From what I can see of the people like me, we get better, but we never get well. Paul Simon wrote that. Years ago, there were tribes that roamed the earth, and every tribe had a magic person. Well, now, as you know, all the tribes have been dispersed, but every so often you meet a magic person, and every so often you meet someone from your tribe. Which is how I felt when I met Paul Simon. Paul and I had the secret handshake of shared sensibility, you know? We understood each other perfectly. Obviously, we didn't always agree, but we understood the terms of our disagreements. My mother used to say, "You know, dear, Paul can be very charming when he wants to be." And my father just wanted Paul to write an album for him. Anyway, Paul and I dated for 6 years, we were married for two, divorced for one, and then we had good memories of each other. So what do you think we did? No, we didn't remarry, we dated again, which is exactly what you want to do after you've been married and divorced. Samuel Johnson once said that remarrying, and he's not talking about marrying the same person here, just remarrying, is the triumph of hope over experience. So for me, remarrying the same person is the triumph of nostalgia over judgment. So Paul and I were together for over 12 years, off and on, and we traveled to a bunch of places, all over the world, really. The last place we went together was the Amazon, which I highly recommend, by the way, if you like mosquitoes. Anyway, when we got back, Paul wrote an album based on South American music called Rhythm of the Saints. And on this album is the last song he ever wrote about me. And it's called She Moves On. An ironic title. Now, by the way, if you can get Paul Simon to write a song about you, do it! Because he is so brilliant at it. Anyway, one of the lyrics in the song goes like this. She's like a top, she cannot stop. So, yeah, he knew me. But the lyric I really wanted to tell you about was this. And I'm afraid that I'll be taken, abandoned and forsaken, in her cold coffee eyes. Yep, I'm a bitch. Now, Paul didn't just write unpleasant songs about me. You know that song, Graceland? She's come back to tell me she's gone, as if I didn't know that, as if I didn't know my own bed, as if I didn't notice the way she brushed her hair from her forehead. See? Recognize me now? He wrote other nice things about our time together, but you know how with exes you tend to remember more of the negative things than the positive ones? No? I guess it's only me then. He wrote another song called Allergies, and the lyric from that was, "My heart is allergic to the woman I love, and it's changing the shape of my face." Do you think that's flattering? I don't think it really is. But Paul wrote another album, a beautiful album. Well, they're all beautiful, but this particular one was called Hearts and Bones. And the title song, Hearts and Bones, was about us, and it went like this. One and one half wandering Jews return to their natural coasts to resume old acquaintances, step out occasionally, and speculate who had been damaged the most. But that couldn't be it, because I didn't get permission to reprint those lyrics, so that would be really bad, wouldn't it? Oh, it isn't really bad, because I didn't take any alimony from Paul. So try to think of it this way. You're listening to my alimony. And lovely alimony it is. One and one half wandering Jews speculate who had been damaged the most. Guess who won that contest? Poor Paul. He had to put up with a lot with me. I think ultimately I fell under the heading good anecdote, bad reality. I was really good for material, but when it came to day-to-day living, I was a little more than he could take. We once had a fight on our honeymoon where I said, "Not only do I not like you, I don't like you personally." We tried to keep the argument going after that, but we were laughing too hard. Another time he said to me, "You're the only girl I know that compliments herself." And I said, "I think it's sweet that I do it, though." And the last one was, he said, "I'm right, and you know I'm right." And I said, "Maybe, but I'm younger, and I'm willing to go all night." So, I married Paul at 26. We divorced when I was 28. And at 29, I went into rehab. Not because I needed it, but because I was doing research for my novel, Postcards from the Edge, and I needed to meet some real drug addicts and alcoholics to give the book some veracity. Sadness Squared. Okay, have it your way. I'm a drug addict. You know how they say religion is the opiate of the masses? Well, I took masses of opiates religiously. But you cannot chalk it up to my goofy childhood. You can try, but you're going to have a hard time. Because my brother, Todd, coincidentally, had the same exact childhood and, freakishly, the same parents. But Todd has never had a substance abuse problem. So it's not what you're given, it's how you take it. Now, my brother is born-again Christian. But what I like to say about that is, what father could Todd find who was more famous than Eddie Fisher, but that he could talk to every day? Because you can. Oh, Jesus. Now, I'd always written, ever since I was about 14, you know, poems, journals, stuff like that. But when I was 28, I was interviewed for Esquire magazine. And the interview turned out funny, I guess. I mean, it had one-liners in it like, "Instant gratification takes too long." Anyway, a publishing house saw the interview and they liked it, so they wrote me a letter asking me if I wanted to write a book. And that letter was forwarded to me in the rehab. And I was glad to get mail from anybody. But I did. I did want to write a book, and I knew what the first line would be. Maybe I shouldn't have given the guy who pumped my stomach my phone number. But he'll never call me anyway. No one will ever call me again. And this was actually based on a true thing. See, the doctor that pumped my stomach sent me flowers with a note that read, I can tell you're a very warm and sensitive person. All that from the contents of my stomach. I was tempted to marry him so I could tell people how we met. Anyway, I wrote Postcards from the Edge in Los Angeles when I was 28. Then I got back together with Paul again, so I wrote the screenplay for Postcards in New York. And then they start filming the movie in Los Angeles with Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine. Well, I want to be on that set. So I start flying out to L.A. from New York a lot. And this was really bad for my relationship with Paul. Pretty soon, we both knew it was over. He might have known a little sooner than I did. Mike Nichols used to say about us that we were two flowers, no gardener. No one was minding the relationship. One time, when I was flying back to L.A., one of the last times, Paul and I had been fighting all morning, so he drove me to the airport to get rid of me faster, and I was about to get on the plane, and I turned to him and said, "You'll feel bad if I crash." And he shrugged and said, "Maybe not." Oh, and around that time, I got a call from my business office that Bob Dylan wanted my phone number. And I said, "Fuck you. You get that stalker away from me. I don't want any more 60s icons fucking up my life." That's what I said in my head. Out loud, I said, "Absolutely, I'll be waiting by the phone." Dylan wasn't calling to ask me on a date. He was calling because this cologne company had contacted him to see if he would endorse a cologne called Just Like a Woman. Bob didn't like that name, but he liked the idea of endorsing a cologne, and he wanted to know if I had any good cologne idea names. Do I look like someone who would be wandering around with a bunch of cologne names rattling around in my head? Well, tragically, I did. I did have quite a few ideas for cologne names, and so I told them to Bob. There was ambivalence for that scent of confusion, arbitrary for the man who doesn't give a shit how he smells, and empathy, feel like them, smell like this. Well, Bob actually liked those, and then he said he thought he might like to open a beauty salon. And I said, "What, like Tangled Up and Blown?" Anyway, a couple of weeks later, I saw George Harrison at this dinner party, as one does. So I tell him about the Bob call, and he says, "Don't worry, because, you know, whenever Bob is on the road for a long time, he starts thinking about finding a regular job. You know, a job that will take him off the road." It turns out that Bob had phoned George the week before to see if he wanted to open the Traveling Wilbury Hotel. So a short time after this, I invite Bob to a party at my house, and he arrives with his girlfriend, who was my neighbor at the time, and he's wearing a parka with sunglasses. And I say, "Thank God you wore that, Bob, because sometimes late at night here, the sun gets really, really bright, and then it snows." Later at the party, I introduce Bob to Meryl Streep, and he takes her hand and he says, "Oh, yeah, I know you. You were great in..." And while he's holding her hand, she now has to go through what turned out to be basically all her movies, which takes a while because his favorite turned out to be Ironweed. My mother doesn't always come to my parties. She doesn't have to, really, because she's right next door and can listen to them from across the driveway. But she's always been there for me. I mean, obviously, she was upset about my drug addiction, what mother wouldn't be. But on some level, she wasn't as upset as she was with my failure to do a nightclub act. Well, that and dating an agent. She grounded me for weeks when she found out about that. But when he ended up fathering her extraordinary granddaughter, Billy, all was forgiven. One of my dozens of psychiatrists once told me that it's important to be able to distinguish the difference between a problem and an inconvenience. The Oxford English Dictionary defines a problem as a thing thrown or put forward, hence a question propounded for solution, a set task, a difficult or puzzling question proposed for solution. The first use of the word was in 1382. So I suppose prior to that, there was either no way to put a name to one's difficulties, or everyone lived in a world of different levels of inconvenience. Then, after 1382, problemizing could be the order of the day. An inconvenience, on the other hand, is defined as being troublesome. This was in the mid-1600s, so I imagine there were 300 years of problems between 1382 and 1656. But no matter what the dictionary says, in my opinion, a problem derails your life, and an inconvenience is not being able to get a nice seat on the underailed train. Now, given that, I've had 3.5 problems. Dead guy in my bed, substance abuse, and manic depression. My final little problemette stems from the difficulty I seem to have in romantic relationships. Specifically, I'm referring to the last categorically serious relationship I had. I was left by a man for a man. Billy's father left me for a man named Scott when she was 1 year old, making Scott the man who got the man that got away. Anyway, armed with my understanding between a problem and an inconvenience, I realize I've been blessed with very few problems in my life. I mean, let's face it, to complain about my childhood or even a sizable portion of my life would be as unattractive as it would be inaccurate. I had a very privileged life growing up, a beautiful, loving, eccentric mother, an even-tempered, and consequently odd to me, bright, kind, religious brother, a charming, handsome, womanizing, yet virtually absent father, lovely grandparents, and a series of dogs and a bird. I mean, I had it all. Which is to say, I had a hearty mix of good and not so hot, like many people. Right after I got sober, the first time, an interviewer asked me if I was happy, and I said, among other things. Happy is one of the many things I'm likely to be over the course of a day, and certainly over the course of a lifetime. But I think if you have the expectation that you're going to be happy throughout your life, more to the point, if you have a need to be comfortable all the time, well, among other things, you have the makings of a classic drug addict or alcoholic, which obviously is what I became. But actually, through therapy and exposure to the wisdom found in 12-step programs and beyond, I've gotten an enormous portion of my compulsion for comfort under control. One night, I had to go to a meeting, this 3-hour meeting I've gone to every week for the last 10 years. By the way, no, I haven't stayed sober for that long, but my failure to achieve long-term sobriety is just that, my failure, not the failure of the program. I first started going to meetings when I was 28. But it was at this particular 3-hour meeting that I heard someone say that I didn't have to like meetings, I just had to go to them. Well, this was a revelation to me. I thought I had to like everything I did. And for me, to like everything I did meant, well, among other things, that I needed to take a boatload of dope. Which I did for many, many years. But if what this person told me were true, then I didn't have to actually be comfortable all the time. If I could, in fact, learn to experience a quota of discomfort, it would be awesome news. And if I could consistently go to that 3-hour meeting, I could also exercise and I could write. In short, I could actually be responsible. But I didn't learn this, until after three of my 3.5 problems had occurred. The overdose, the bipolar diagnosis, and the man that got the man that got away. It seemed to me like a lot of my trouble showed up in sex, it being the alleged road to love and all. In almost